is that you can always run software on somebody else's computer. And so particularly for expensive pieces of software, that means that, you know, I have to purchase one copy, throw it on my server, and now my students can run it remotely using X11 connections and not have to worry about maintaining 6-7 different copies for the lab. Nuplot, which is the software we're going to talk about today, or in this session, is free software, but you could imagine that if I were using a more sophisticated software package like MATLAB or Maple or Mathematica to do some numerical analysis, the same kind of thing would apply. I basically just tell them, hey, log into the server, you can access it from there, and it's fairly straightforward. Today, this session is going to talk a little bit about both theory and sort of the practical things for doing model fitting. And I thought, you know, to start off, we would just have a little bit of a discussion about, you know, what is a scientific model? And so here's where I get to hear from you guys. I mean, I want to hear some of your ideas and what you think about this question, so we can maybe come up with some consensus here. So anybody have any ideas about what makes up a scientific model?
Mathematica is questions.
Mathematica is, what was the second part?
Mathematica is questions to run a program.
So that, in some sense, I would agree with you, but I think that's probably a little bit above and beyond what the normal student would say. So yes, a scientific model has to be formalized, right? I mean, it's not enough to, I mean, you can imagine back in third grade, you did the model of the solar system, right? You had it, maybe you did this. You made a little model of the solar system, and you would measure little like bars between the planets, and it would swing around. You know, that's, in some sense, that's a model. And it has some useful properties of models, but it's not formalized in the sense that, you know, you can't predict how long the orbit of Mars is from that model, right? So in some sense, you have to be able to give it explicit definitions like you might in a computer software like Mathematica or MATLAB. Other thoughts? So is a model useful if it's not predictive? I mean it can be. I mean the solar system model, if we go back, it doesn't predict some things, but it does predict others. I mean, so, and you can sort of predict what the closest distance of approach between two planets might be if you swing them around so that they're all aligned. That has some useful predictions. I think that model also shows that all models have limitations, right? So that's sort of inherent in what we discuss, is that, yes, a model can give you some predictive abilities, but it's unlikely that a model is going to be able to predict everything. And so when I think about what a scientific model is, I usually think of some kind of equation or mathematical formula that allows me to predict things that I might want to know, and since I'm a biochemist, that I might want to know about particular biochemical systems. Okay, and so those are based on, you know, this is really what physical chemistry is all about. It's based on taking things like equilibria and enthalpies and delta G's and using those numerical values to be able to make predictions about how different types of chemical systems will behave under different circumstances. Okay, and so when we think about models, we think about something that you can test, something that has some parameters that you can maybe change and tweak, and ultimately you'd like to take your model and compare it to some real data. And so if you can't take your model and compare it against any experiment, then I would say it's probably not so good of a model, or it might be an imaginative model. And so models generally explain an observable quantity. In our case, it might be something like how many molecules are bound solubility, but in your case, if you're working in, with cells or bacteria, you might think about growth rate, so how quickly or how efficiently cells grow in a particular media. They express that quantity in terms of understandable parameters and fundamental constants, and so rate constants, again, hopefully you've all had Chem 1, so you at least know a little bit about what a rate constant might be. An equilibrium constant, and so the ratio of products and reactants at equilibrium. This can be things like taking Planck's constant if you're doing real hardcore physics. It doesn't have to be strictly physical chemistry constants, but generally that's something that I end up working with a lot. And hopefully you guys have at least a little bit of a understanding of what an equilibrium constant means. And then it should be predictive, right? So we should be able to make our measurements and back out some parameters like an equilibrium constant or a rate constant and say, okay, this is the rate constant we observe. But then we should be able to predict how the system is going to behave under a different set of conditions. So the typical one that I use a lot from Chem 2 is you're often given, I have these initial concentrations of my reactants, and I see this rate, and then I change my initial concentration of reactants, and I see a new rate, and I do it again. And so, the Chem 2 approach is to say, okay, what's the order? What's the reaction order for each reactant? So you might determine that it's a first order in the first compound, and a second order in the second compound. And then what's the rate constant for that particular rate law? Right? But the rate law is essentially a model. Once you determine what the rate constant is and what the reaction orders of everything are, so if I go back here and draw or write what I mean using our wet erase board, right, so if I say that my reaction velocity is equal to K times the concentration of A raised to the power A and the concentration of B raised to the power B. Remember, this is the order for each reactant, and this is my rate constant. Okay, and so I determine that A is 1 and B is 1 and K is, let's say, 1 times 10 to the third per molar. Now this might be more chemistry than any of you care to have, but anyway, if I determine what that rate law is, obviously I've determined that from existing observations, but it's also predictive, right? If I plug in a new value for the concentration of A and a new value for the concentration of B, I'm going to be able to predict what that rate or that reaction rate is going to be under a different set of conditions. And so this is a model in and of itself where our parameters would be the rate constant here and maybe the reaction orders themselves. Okay, so models all have these sort of common properties where you express an observable or some kind of observable quantity in terms of things that you can control and parameters which usually represent the underlying chemistry or the underlying physics of the situation. Okay, and so this comes up all the time, right? So we have radioactive decay here of barium 137, and again, this is something that we may not interact with or do on a daily basis, but you can imagine taking a Geiger counter up to a sample of barium 137 and you measure a certain number of counts on the Geiger counter every 30 seconds, and essentially you see, as you would expect, that according to the radioactive rate law or the radioactive decay, that eventually the barium decays to what we think is some kind of background radiation value here. Okay, and here we could relate. Again, this is a half-life type of an equation. And so again, you don't have to remember this, but we have E raised to the minus time over 1/2 or your half-life. So this is just a constant, 0.6931. And so we have the observable, which is the number of counts in 30 seconds, is equal to some initial constant times e to the minus a whole bunch of other constants. And then the half-life is another parameter. And then b sort of represents our baseline or background radiation. So this is essentially a scientific model. We have a parameter a. We have a parameter half, or T1/2, representing our half-life. And we have a parameter B, representing our background radiation. And you know, most of the time, we're interested in what the half-life is. But how would you get this otherwise? You'd need to be able to do some way of reconciling this equation with the observed counts that you have. And so this is essentially what a model fitting type of a problem is. This is probably the simplest type of model that you can come up with in chemistry, which is why I'm using it here. And now we basically have a fitting problem, right? You can imagine, just like maybe when you were in high school, you took some rulers and you try to find the best fit line between a whole bunch of points. You know, here we're basically trying to find the best fit exponential decay that fits through all of these points, and when we can do that, we end up with presumably one of the correct number of parameters. And so, if you want to, I think it's probably instructive to go to the website, and I have on here this exponential decay worksheet. And so, go to that, download the worksheet. We're gonna sort of see how this is done in practice. Oh man. Oh, there we go. Good. Okay, so this is a worksheet that contains the data that I just showed you on that slide. So if you go here to the graph, you can see that's the exact data set that I showed you. So this is some experimental data that somebody has measured using exponential decay. And so, and what we'd like to do is sort of show you the basic process of how you might take data like this and how you might take a physical model and make the two agree. Okay, so again, in your own individual, you know, experiences and labs, you're going to see, you know, I'm not going to go through the derivation of this model. I mean, basically we have some background, which is a constant, which is basically this stuff coming off of the Earth from the natural background radiation. Half-life is obviously how long it takes for half of your radionuclide to decay. And this initial parameter is representing something about how much you started with. Right? But the actual why is this e to the minus whatever over t, that's probably beyond what we can go over here in this course. But you know, basically we can take different counts at different times t, and we end up with a whole bunch of different points, and we're trying to make or find values of the half-life, the background radiation, and this initial parameter A that give us a nice smooth curve through this, or smooth fit through this data. And if we can do that, then we can say that our model that we're talking about, that we've derived here, agrees with the data that we observe. And we can then take some of those parameters, like the half-life, and say, okay, well, that's something that I can wrap my head around, and the half-life for barium-137 is going to be whatever we find it to be. And then we could use that in other types of situations, like if we're cleaning up nuclear waste or something like that. Obviously, it's not going to be a huge problem because most of it's gone by 600 seconds. So thankfully, this isn't a bad, bad nucleus as far as radioactive decay. Okay, so there's several tabs down here in our Excel workbook. And again, We don't have time to cover all about Excel. You can take my tools course if you really want to. But this is essentially the data. And then here on the next tab, we have the data with the parameters that the fit, quote unquote. And then there's another tab here called residuals that we'll talk about in a minute. Okay, but if I go back to the original data slide, you see that there's several things that we can change. So this table here, that contains all of the measurements that I showed you in that graph on the next tab. And so, you know, that's pretty much what you might make if you were doing some observations on your own. You'd obviously have the time that you measure your exponential or your decay in. You have the counts that you observe from your Geiger counter in this case. And then generally, you always have some kind of uncertainty associated with your data. The uncertainty in this case is measured from something called a Poisson distribution. But at the very worst case, you basically take the measurement a few times, you calculate a standard deviation, and that's your uncertainty there. So you can always get a measurement and an uncertainty. And what we have here are some model parameters. And so this value corresponds to the initial background or the value of A that's plotted on this worksheet. This is the value of the half-life. And then this is the value of the background radiation. So you see, I've already put in numbers that fit pretty well. And so if you go here to the third tab, you can see that's essentially that reddish-orangish line is essentially the exponential decay plotted with those values of the numbers. And so you can see here it looks pretty good. But if I go back here and change my half-life, let's make this 160 seconds and go back to the graph. You can see that the graph moved over a little bit, so the fit's not quite as good. And if we make it 200, now you can see we're basically no longer shooting through all the points. So this worksheet is designed to sort of give you an interactive ability to change the different model parameters and look to see what the effect is on the agreement between the model curve and the data that's been observed. Okay, and so I can also change the background radiation. For example, if I want to go up here, I can make this 15. And so you can see that shifts the curve up as you would expect. And so we've increased the amount of background background counts. And we basically move the curve up. So this is a useful paradigm because it gives us an idea on how a computer might take data that we've observed and optimize the agreement between a model function or a target function and our data. Okay, and so how does it do that? Well, again, there's all sorts of theory that goes into this, and unfortunately we don't have the time to work through all of it, but hopefully this is enough to make you guys dangerous when it comes to model fit. That's the goal here. So we have this function here that we're calling the chi-squared function. So the Greek letter x is called chi, and this is normalized to the number of degrees of freedom. So we'll see what that means in a second, but essentially what we're doing is we're saying, okay, we have some model function, some f of x. In this case, it's our exponential decay. And we can, if we're given a value of A, a value of the half-life, and a value of the background radiation, we should be able to predict the number of counts at any time t, right? So if I say the half-life is 120, and the background radiation is 10, and the initial starting value is 140. You can plug that into that equation, and at any value of t, you can predict, using those parameters, what the number of counts should be as a function of time. Okay, but that's not going to tell you how well it agrees with your experimental data. So in some sense, you want to say, okay, I'm trying to find the best value of A, T1 half, and B that I can. And I want to find that best value by minimizing the difference between my target function for A, T1 half, and B, and the observed values for, you know, whatever my observations are. Okay, so that means if I'm taking a difference, if I'm minimizing a difference, there's going to be subtraction in there somewhere. Okay, so if this is, let's just consider it for one data point, right? If this is my observed first data point, so let's go back and take a look. So I'm talking about, so right now I'm pretty much bang on, right? So the difference between my model and my first data point is essentially zero, right? But I'm talking about the value that I calculate at time t equals zero minus the, or I guess vice versa, my experimental value at times t equals zero minus the value that I calculate. Okay, so that difference is represented by the difference between the orange line, and for the first data point, it's going to be this point. For the second data point, it's going to be this point. The third data point is going to be this point. The fourth data point. So essentially, I have a whole bunch of differences between my model prediction and my experimental data, right? And so, on the one hand, I want to take a difference between my model prediction, or my experimental data, which is y, and my model prediction, which is f of x, right? So this is the function, you know, a times e to the minus whatever plus b. So this is this at a particular time point. This is my observed data at a particular time point. So I take the difference, and I'm summing them up, right? But I'm not just summing the differences. Right, because you could imagine some differences, if I take the difference of my experimental versus my calculated point, they're going to be positive. And some differences, if I take my experimental minus my calculated point, are going to be negative. You know, if I have a good fit, I would expect some values to be above the fit, some values to be below the fit. And so it's not sufficient just to sum up the difference. Right? What I really need to do is sum up the difference squared, because the squared is always going to be positive. Right? So I take the difference between those two, and now I square it. And so that square is always going to be positive. And if I minimize the sum of those squared differences, you could imagine that I'm going to have a pretty good agreement between my model and my experimental data, my observations. Right? And so essentially this chi-squared parameter is a target function that we define, and it has all sorts of good statistical probability or statistical properties. But it's a target function that we define that if we say that if we minimize the chi-squared value, then we know that we have a reasonably good agreement between our experimental data and our model at those parameters. And so how do we minimize chi-squared? Now there's other stuff in here that we haven't talked about, like the uncertainty. That comes in there as well. Basically, if you're very uncertain about a point, you don't want to give that point a lot of weight. You want to say, okay, I'm pretty uncertain about that point, so I'm going to only weight it a little bit, and I'll use these other points, which are really, really well known, to define the parameters as much as I can. And this number of degrees of freedom is a statistical term to make sure you're not overestimating overfitting your data, or trying to give you as best an idea as that as you can. So if you look here, back in this worksheet, and again, this is sort of the best way I think that there is to figure out what it is, or to teach this. So I have some parameters, and I have a reduced chi-squared down here, and I have a number of degrees of freedom. Now these are calculated automatically, so if you look at the equation for the number of degrees of freedom. Okay, so what this equation is doing, I might have to get this now because I'm not that tall. So you can see it's summing up column F. And column F is basically just the difference between your calculated value and the observed value, and then you square. Okay, so you divide by the uncertainty squared. So essentially this value, this contribution to chi squared, if I click on that now, you can see it takes the difference squared, which is E15 squared, divides it by the uncertainty squared, and then that's your contribution to chi squared. So again, each one of these cells here, F15, F16, F11, or F17, represents what's in this set of curly braces. And then when I want to calculate chi squared, again, I take the sum of all of those and then divide by the number of degrees of freedom. Okay, and so there's different ways of doing this, but this is sort of the easiest way that I think we can use. And so what I can do now is I can look at my reduced chi squared as I change the model parameters, and I can see the reduced chi squared go up, meaning that the agreement is getting worse, or go down, meaning that the agreement is getting better. And so let's take this and move it towards, I don't remember what our initial values are, but let's, I think this was 145, I think this one was 9, and this might have been 140, I don't know. But you can see, when I made those changes, now my reduced chi-squared goes from something like 30 to something like 0.6. And if I look here back on my graph with the fit, now that line, which is represents our model, is now going through most of the points. Okay, so let's explore this a little bit more. So what is the program doing? What does the computer have to do if it wants to optimize the agreement between your model and your experimental data? Right? So we've talked about qualitatively it has to find a minimum in chi squared. Well, that, you know, if you're thinking about, well, a minimum, that brings me back to calculus. And in some sense, yeah, that's what it's doing. It's finding a minimum, but it's a computer. It can take a derivative. But for lots of these functions, it's not going to be able to take a derivative easily. And so what does it do? Well, let's do an example here. So we're going to say, suppose that we know that the background radiation has to be 10, and we know that the initial height is going to be 140. Actually, we'll do this here. I think it's probably easier. We want to find the value of the half-life that gives us the best agreement between our model and the experimental data. Okay? So let's do that. Let's see what that would look like. So we're going to have T1/2 here, and we're going to have chi squared here. And so let's just try a couple of values. So we can do 100, 110, 130, 140, 150, 160, 180, 210. Okay, so the computer doesn't know which value it is per se, but computers are very fast at doing computations. And so I can go in and I can basically pretend I'm the computer. I can go in and set this to be 100. And now my reduced chi-squared is 3.8. Okay, I can set it at 110. Now it's 2.7. 130. 1.2. 40, 0.76, 150, 56, 160, 0.60, 180,
137, 138, and 210, 4.3. So we've just done essentially what a computer can do. We've gone through and we've calculated the value of chi squared for different values of a given parameter, and we're looking to see which one gives us the minimum value of chi squared. And so, you know, a computer is going to basically do some quick numerical checking, but as humans, we like to look at things that are graphs, or we like to look at graphical information. And so you can see, if I plot this, this is chi squared on the y-axis, and the half-life on the x-axis, I immediately see that my half-life is probably going to be around here somewhere. Right? And so this is how a computer can go. It can systematically modify the half-life. Now, we just did this for one dimension, right? But a computer can do this in multiple dimensions. It can modify the half-life, the value of A, and the value of B. And you can imagine this forming some kind of like hypersurface, where you have chi-squared as your surface, and it's sort of curling down into a minimum, where your parameters give you the best agreement or the lowest value of chi squared. Okay, and so a computer would do this in three dimensions simultaneously. We can work in one dimension and we can see that we have a nice plot of chi squared versus half-life. Okay, and so a computer is going to basically go through and it's going to systematically modify A, T1/2, and B, and it's going to try to find the minimum value of chi squared. And as I've already convinced you, when you've minimized chi squared, you have the optimal agreement between your model and the experimental data. Now, the way that computers do this is a lot more sophisticated than what we're doing here, right? And that's basically a computer science course in and of itself. So we're not going to talk about that, but we can basically show you some software and some approaches so that you can, if you're faced with a situation where you have to do some model fitting, you can say, okay, well, let's come up with a way to do this and get some answers that maybe make sense that you can then, you know, derive, you know, what you think that the half-life or the time constant should be. So to show you quickly how to do this in Excel, and you guys are welcome to keep this. You know, this is based on you know, some basic models, basic equations in Excel, but it can be extended to any number of different types of models. And so if you have a model of your own system that you want to expand this to, you're welcome to use this as a starting point. I put this online for a reason. It doesn't use anything terribly difficult. You know, the main thing that you'll see here is, you know, this is essentially a cell that contains our model value, right? So, yeah, where did that?
So, just out of curiosity, we couldn't actually calculate the uncertainty. So, for our experiment, that's going to depend on our instrumentation, right? Just going back to uncertainty.
It depends. Lots of systems like MyNMR will give you an uncertainty that you can estimate based on the noise in the system, right? But the best way to calculate uncertainty is to prepare three different samples and take the standard deviation of the, like, average them, and that's the value that you use, and then take the standard deviation of the average and use that for your uncertainty.
Okay.
Right? So, and again, your PI might have a different recommendation. I mean, the NMR, we use the spectral noise, but that doesn't really account for the fact that, you know, maybe the student's sample was more concentrated one time versus another. And so you really want to estimate, if you can, what's the real statistical variation of this measurement. And the best way to do that is to make the measurement several times and report the standard deviation.
Okay.
But in this case, you know, the Poisson statistics basically says that the uncertainty in the count, like if I'm counting things, like radioactive decay events, or even if you think about electoral polls, and they count, you know, 5,000 people, you know, deciding whether they want to vote for Trump or Hillary, right? The uncertainty in that measurement is basically the square root of 5,000. And that's a statistical model they use to estimate the uncertainty of those measurements. And so basically, if you look at these are the uncertainty here is the square root of the number over here. Okay, but if I were doing this for my own students, and we have done this, I basically say do the experiment 3 times, take the standard deviation, and use that for your uncertainty. Because that's sort of the best way to get it. I mean, the other ways are making assumptions about the data that may not always be true. And it also is a way for me to say, is your experiment reproducible, right? If they do the experiment once and it works, I'm like, that's awesome. But then if they do it like 2-3 times and it doesn't work, I'm like, well, maybe a miracle occurred to me. We got to revisit whether we're actually doing the experiment right. So this gets at reproducibility as well if you just do it again. Anyway, so you can see up here, this is A, so B6 is our initial height. The only thing, again, if you haven't seen this format before, the dollar signs up here tell me that that's a constant. And so if I drag this formula down for this table, that means it's not going to change the cell reference here. It's going to keep it at B6 the whole time. But then we have, you know, here's your exponential. That number is ln2 over, you know, B7 is your half-life. So they actually color it for you. It's nice. A15 is your time, and B8 is in here. So you can see this is basically just using standard Excel math with some tricks to keep the cell referencing constant. But you could, in principle, put any model that you want in here. I mean, we're going to do an example of model fitting using Nuplot here after we finish through these slides. And you could do the same thing with single site binding, which is the example we're going to use for the rest of the lesson, the workshop. So anyway, we have our model here, we're calculating it. And so basically you want to tell Excel to change these 3 cells and minimize the value of this cell. And so there is a way to do this in Excel. You have to have something called the solver installed. This is something that is included in Excel, and so it is always there. Or it is there if you don't have it installed. Although I'm not seeing it. Oh, maybe I didn't install it on this one. Let's save this to the desktop. Okay. And we go to options, add-ins, solver. And I want to make that active. Yep. Okay, so to do that again, you go here to options, add-ins, you hit go when it comes to manage add-ins, you click on the solver, you hit okay, and now when you go here to the data tab, you'll see that you have this solver button. Okay, so I'm going to click on that. And it brings up some options here. And so it says set objective. This is the cell that Excel wants to minimize or maximize or hit to be 0. And so this is going to be the value that we set for chi-squared. And so since we have a cell that corresponds to chi-squared, I'm going to click that and hit OK. OK, and we want it to change the variable cells given here. Well, now we want it to basically change B6, 7, and 8. That's already set, but we can set it up again. So we'll hit OK. And we want our objective to be minimized. So we hit OK, or we hit that. And there's some other options here. You can also add some, you know, bounds. Suppose you want your chi-square always to be positive. In this case, there's really no way to make, or you want your parameters to be positive. But in this case, it should just find it just fine without any additional information. And so once we've set that up, we're going to hit solve.
And what it's done is it's found the values for A, T1 half, and B that give me the what it thinks is the lowest reduced chi-squared possible, which in this case is 0.43. And if you look at these numbers, they've now changed. And if we hit OK on this, and we look at our graph with the fit, you can see that it's a pretty good fit of the data. And so, again, if you have an Excel spreadsheet set up with all the numerical stuff that you can use the solver to optimize parameters given a set target function. But that's a little bit of a pain. I mean, Excel is a great program. I love it. But setting up all this for one type of fitting is a bit of a hassle. And so that's why there's other programs that are out there that make this a little bit better. The other thing that this doesn't give you, and it's mostly because I didn't code it in, but this gives you no idea on what it thinks the uncertainty on the parameters is. And so if you're saying, here's the uncertainty on my data points, what's the uncertainty of my half-life that I measure? Here it says it's 144.6. But is that 144.6 plus or minus 0.00001? Or is 144.6 plus or minus 1? 144.6 plus or minus 10? So this method doesn't give you that kind of information, and other software packages will. Okay, so Excel is a great program, but it also has some limitations. This is great for quick and dirty fitting, but I would use something else if I needed some uncertainties on my parameters themselves. Okay, so this is the example of the curve that we just got. And so this is basically getting at what I just talked about. The accepted half-life for barium-137. So if you go up and go to the NIST database and say, what is the half-life of this thing? Their value is 153 seconds. And so, is our value of 144.6 good? Well, it really depends on what we're saying the value of 144.6 is. If we say that it's 144.6 plus or minus 10, then yeah, that's really well within agreement there. If we say it's 144.6 plus or minus 0.1, well, those two numbers don't agree all that well. And so understanding what the uncertainty in your parameters is actually a big part of model fitting. And it's, I'm giving you sort of the simple solution here in this workshop, but there's all sorts of research that goes on what's the best way to estimate the uncertainty in your parameters, and what's the best way to do this model fitting. And so this is a question that we have to sort of deal with, and it's a question that Excel really isn't easily prepared to give us in a general sense. Okay, so here's some examples of biochemical models that you might be interested in, or that you might find how to use, or you'd use in this summer. Single site binding, if I have a protein and a ligand, and they're forming some kind of complex, the degree of binding, and we'll talk actually about this here in a minute or two, is given by this expression, where P0 and L0 are the total concentrations of protein that you start with, and the total concentrations of ligand that you have. And here's the equilibrium constant here. And so again, here's our observable. This is the observable number over here, the degree of binding. And presumably we know what the total protein concentration is. If this is some kind of drug, we know what the total drug concentration is. And so our parameter is the equilibrium constant. So we're trying to find the best equilibrium constant that agrees with our degree of binding here. If we think about protein folding, so proteins have a tertiary structure, but if you heat them up, they eventually unfold, right? That tertiary structure falls apart. And so the fraction folded, which is something that we can measure in a lot of experiments, is given by 1 over 1 plus k. And if I remember back that equilibrium constants are delta G minus T delta S,
I can derive this for the temperature dependence of the fraction folded in terms of the enthalpy and the entropy of unfolding. And so here's another model that relates the fraction folded, and here the parameters would be delta H and delta S. And I would vary temperature and observe how the fraction folding depends on temperature. Okay, so these are two sort of biochemical models that are very standard. Let's see what else is here. And we'll return to this one. So we'll do an example of this with Nuplot. But say now that you've done this, again, we're going back to the exponential decay. So how do you know this is a good fit? Well, the three parameters that you guys can use, or the three ways that you can use to assess whether this is a decent fit or not, is first of all, does it look good? So if you plot the optimized parameters or the optimized model against your data, you would think that model should go through all the points, right? So that's the first way that if you're trying to assess a fit, you can use that to sort of measure whether you think it looks good. And in this case, it does. You can look at the error bars, and here the error bars are all well within the model parameter values. So that's sort of the first thing that you should look at. The second thing that you should look at is you want your normalized chi-squared to be around 1 or less. And so if you calculate what the chi-squared over the degrees of freedom is, and that's less than 1, then that's another good indicator that you have a very good fit, that your model with the optimized parameters agrees with the experimental data. So that's also good. And then the third way to think about this or to assess whether you have a good fit is to basically plot the difference between your observed data and the model that you've calculated. Okay, and so this is called a residuals plot. And so essentially what I've done is my residual for every point is simply the observed value minus the calculated value. And what you should see, or what we do see here, is most of the points are close to 0, meaning that there's a small difference between your observed value and your experimental value. Most of the points are within an error bar, meaning that the difference that you do see between your observed and your experimental value is within the uncertainty in your measurement. And the points themselves are sort of randomly distributed up and down. You don't really see a trend here. It's not like there's 500 points up above the baseline, then it goes down to another 500 points below the baseline. And so, on average, yeah, you see some points that are above, some points are down, but essentially it's a random distribution. You don't see any patterns when you plot your residuals. And so the residuals plot is here as well. You can look at that. But what happens if I change this and make it a non-optimal value? Okay, so let's make this 180. And so if you look at your graph with the fit, I mean, it's like, it's not a very good fit, but it goes through these points here at the end. But now when you look at your residuals, you see a definite trend. You see all these residuals are below the baseline, and they don't really approach the baseline until here at the end. And so looking at your residuals plot is another way that you can say, hey, this fit doesn't actually look good. Maybe there's something else going on here. And when there's something else going on, yes, it's kind of bad because you might be asked to do the experiment again. But when there's something else going on, sometimes that means that there's something scientifically interesting that now you're like, hey, this model doesn't account for this data. Maybe I can publish a paper by coming up with a better model. So just because your agreement isn't perfect doesn't mean that that's the end of the road. Sometimes that means it's the start of something new. And if you don't have the statistical way to assess whether your fit is actually, whether your curve agrees with your data, you really can't get there because, you don't have the statistical tools. And so this is a very useful statistical tool to tell you whether things are actually working as they should, or whether your model is a good representation of the data that you've collected. Okay, so there's another example. So if your model overpredicts the data, it's always positive. Again, that's telling you that something is off.
Okay. You can read this. So we're going to look at a practical example. So again, the whole purpose of this is to be practical and to give you guys some hands-on experience doing this. And so this is a system that Ed Lewis works on. It's basically small molecule binding to DNA. And so this DNA structure is called a G quadruplex. Basically, you have a whole bunch of guanines in here, and they form planes. And this molecule over here, which is called TMPYP4, is a small molecule drug that binds to this particular structure. And so this G quadruplex is found in a lot of promoter regions before, like, telomerase. Right? And so telomerase is one of those genes that's upregulated in cancer. And for telomerase to be transcribed, this promoter region needs to be not this structure. Right? So if the promoter is in this G quadruplex form, the RNA, or the RNA polymerase, and the RNA polymerase ain't going to be able to bind this guy, and it's not going to be able to transcribe the gene, and it's not going to be able to translate it later on. And so you might think that, hey, if I can find a molecule that binds to this and prevents polymerase from being transcribed, I can turn off that gene and then make it harder for cancers to reproduce. And so that's sort of the whole reasoning that people want to study this. So they bind small molecules to this, they stabilize this form of the DNA. Now the gene can't be transcribed, and essentially the cancer dies because its DNA gets shorter and shorter, and it can't recreate its telomeres. Again, if that molecular biology is over your head, that's fine. The point is, we're looking at binding of this thing, which is our large molecule, to this thing, which is our small molecule. And in this situation, you could imagine that there would be a favorable interaction, right? This is lots of aromatic stuff. It might fit nicely into these sort of pockets between the guanosine planes. But maybe it binds one. Maybe it binds two, so maybe it binds one in here, maybe it binds another one in here, maybe it binds some other ones over here and down there. Right? So it could bind any number of these molecules. And so, in addition to understanding what the association constant is, we might want to know how many binding sites there are as well. And so, chemically, we have, now I apologize, you guys don't have these slides, but chemically, we have this situation. So the DNA binds one ligand and it forms DNAL. So the DNA ligand complex. And then that binds another ligand and then it becomes DNAL2. And then it goes all the way here to the maximum number of binding sites, whether that be 3, 4, 5, 20, however many it can bind. So this is essentially our model. And we can work out the math to this model, right? I mean, this you could represent your equilibrium constant here as products over reactants, just like you did in chemistry one and chemistry two. Then we could assume, though, for this model, that the equilibrium constant of this chemical reaction and the equilibrium constant for this chemical reaction and the equilibrium constant for this chemical reaction are all the same. So whatever that equilibrium constant is, we assume that it's just as favorable here as it is here. And so essentially, each binding event is independent, or is identical, right? So if it binds the first one, it's the same as binding the second one, the third one, and the fourth one. Okay, so that's an assumption that goes into our model that we then have to work out and include in the mathematics. And so we're not going to work through the mathematics here. I'm just going to jump to the conclusion. My group saw a little bit of this on Friday when we worked through some of the math. But essentially, the equation that we're interested in is given here. And so here is our degree of binding
And again, I'm not going to go into what that is, but that's something that you can measure experimentally using equilibrium dialysis. You can use isothermal titration calorimetry. You can use other types of different spectroscopic methods. Suffice it to say that you can measure this experimentally. And we can also measure the free drug or the free ligand concentration. So that's what's given here is L. And if you work through all of the math, oops, on this slide, and you know, basically write out the equilibrium expression and determine what degree of binding is, your equation looks like this. So the degree of binding is equal to the number of binding sites times the equilibrium constant times the ligand concentration over 1 plus the equilibrium constant times the ligand concentration. And so we observe nu and L from our experiments, and then K and N are the model parameters for this particular situation. So this is the equation that we set up. Okay, and again, this would be specific to whatever model you're using. And this is basically N independent identical sites, but if you're working on protein folding, you would have a different equation. And if you're working on you know, something else like modeling population growth under adverse conditions or modeling viral replication, you would have a different model here. This is the model that fits with what we're doing here. Now we can go into the Excel approach again, and so this is some sample data that we're going to download here in a second. But you can see we have the free ligand concentration, so that's free TMPYP4 as a function of degree of binding. And if we plot that function for several different concentration or for several different numbers of sites, you can see that it's not necessarily so obvious. So for 3, which is the red curve, you know, if I plot degree of binding versus free ligand, I get something like this. It agrees pretty well with the first points, but maybe not so well with the end points. So maybe that's not so good. For 4 sites, it agrees pretty well with everything. But for 5 sites, it also agrees pretty well. And so here again, just plotting the data and trying a few different values for the number of binding sites can be instructive. It says, well, there's probably 4 or 5 binding sites here, but you know, I can't tell which one it is, right? So here's a situation where it might be nice to have another piece of software that can do this optimization for you and calculate what N and K should be given this set of observations. And this is very realistic compared to what students might be measuring in the lab. You know, oftentimes you don't get beautiful, you know, points falling on a perfect line. I mean, there usually is some uncertainty in there. Sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down. But the computer can still make sense of it. And so if you go to the website, you can download binding.txt. And so it's right here. And I think for the interest of time, since hopefully everybody just did the Unix tutorial, we can go in and we can do this on the block server. And so what I'm going to do, X is up. So we're gonna basically use nuplot here. Now you all have a little nuplot tutorial that'll cover, you know, how you can do this on your own and some of the more detailed commands of nuplot. But I'm gonna let you guys read that yourself. I mean, we're gonna work through this on the fly here, and we'll just show you quickly how you can use nuplot to fit some data like this. And so I'm gonna log into my own account, hopefully. Yep. And I do have X, so that's good. Okay, and so remember how Yua said that we can transfer files back and forth to the server. And so this is a little bit of transfer craziness, but we're gonna download this file and we can save it. I mean, you can right click it and save it to the desktop too.
Sorry, 15.
Yep. Oh, that's a good thing. Yeah. Well, it's not a good thing.
Let's see if we can't close this out. Okay, so we'll minimize this. Okay, so I'm gone here. I'm downloading binding.txt, so I'll right-click it, save link as, and I'll save it to my desktop. You guys can save it to wherever you want. And if I look at that file, it's basically just, you know, degree of binding, or free ligand concentration versus degree of binding. And so I have, in the first column, again, this is our free ligand concentration. You'll see it's in 10 to the minus 6. So the previous slide, I represent that as micromolar, right? But micromolar in terms of actual molar, you want to put that in 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. So you have to remember your exponents, or your scientific unit modifiers. And then this is the degree of binding. And then this third column represents the uncertainty. And again, in a binding experiment, typically you'd be doing this three times, and you would report, you know, this value would be the average, and then this value would be the uncertainty. So that would be the way to do it. You could also say, you know, assume that there's essentially zero uncertainty and do three separate fits and then take the average of those and report it. So again, there's lots of different ways to do this. Sometimes it's one's better than the other. But anyway, this is what that data is, and it's exactly what I showed you on the PowerPoint slide. And so you can see, you know, our first data point is about 1, and so that's what that is. Next one is about 1.6. And so this is the data that's plotted here. And we want to transfer that into our Unix system. So I've logged into my Unix system. So you can see I'm nfitsky at block. And I've opened up the file window by clicking the little file transfer window. And again, I'm going to have a lot more files in my folder than you will, but that's okay. We're going to drag in. So I'm going to drag the binding.txt over onto my Unix side of things. And now if I type ls binding.txt, you can see the file has been transferred. Okay? Now the Nuplot tutorial that you have in front of you shows you how to install Nuplot on your Windows system or on your Mac. But it's already installed here on Unix, and we can start it just by typing Nuplot. So if I type Nuplot, G-N-U-P-L-O-T, and open it up, you can see it comes right up. Now it'll be slightly different on your PC, but this is essentially all we need here. You can see it, the X should be working. So if I plot 5X plus 2, a window comes open and it looks like a straight line. And so, again, you can play around with Nuplot. We're gonna work on this from a strictly pragmatic point of view, where we're going to just do the fitting and basically show you the bare minimum that you would need to do some fitting here. One of the things that you would want to do is plot your data. And so this is basically just plotting a straight line that I made up. But if I type plot and type a question or a quotation mark, and again, tab is your friend. All I have to do is type BIND and hit tab. So first I downloaded it from the website to my desktop, and then I clicked the file transfer window, and that opens up this guy. And then all I did was I dragged my binding.txt into the left-hand or the right-hand side of that file transfer window.
Okay.
And it's going to ask me here, do I want to overwrite it, because I've already done it once. So one of the things that Nuplot's really nice at is that you don't have to go into Excel and, you know, generate a whole bunch of tables and plots and stuff. You could actually look at your data quite easily using Nuplot, which is one of the reasons I like to teach it to my lab. And so this command here, plot binding.txt in quotes,
with Y error bars. If I hit enter, you can see it basically shows me what my data look like. And so without having to go into Excel, without having to make a graph in Excel, without having to go through all the Y error bar crap in Excel, you can go in and very easily access your data from a simple text file. Now the question is, how do we fit our model to this data that we have here? Because that's really what the purpose of this exercise is. And so Nuplot has a couple of different options here. The first thing that we need to do, though, is go in and define in Nuplot what our model is. Right? So we've got to say, hey, Nuplot, this is the model we want you to fit with. Right now, it's just a software package. It has no idea what we might be doing in terms of fitting this to a binding equation. And so I'm going to create a function in Nuplot. And Nuplot is one of these programs that is fairly user-friendly if you've already seen a whole bunch of Unix. If you haven't seen a whole bunch of Unix, some of this is going to be quite foreign. And again, the Nuplot tutorial walks you through some of the finer points of how to write functions in Nuplot and plot different types of curves. For example, when we come in and we show plot 5x plus 2, again, we're using an asterisk to represent multiplication. The plus sign is pretty self-explanatory. But Nuplot recognizes x as a variable without us having to say anything. And so those types of things might not be so intuitive here. But anyway, so we're going to define our function. And if we go back here to Excel, that's not Excel. Or that is Excel, but that's not what we want to do. If we go back here to PowerPoint, touch that up. Okay, so we want to define this equation in Nuplot, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, well, we have n times, and rather than trying to do keq, I'm just going to do k because I think that's easier. And my x-axis is the ligand concentration. So I'm going to say, okay, rather than trying to say, actually, let's make this a little bigger for you guys so you can read it. There we go. Is that better? Okay. So, it's like maybe a few millimeters up here on the screen, but hopefully it's a little easier to read back there. So we have n times k times x, and that's going to be divided by 1.0 plus k times x. Okay, so here again, n times k times x divided by the quantity 1 plus k times x. Okay, now why did I use 1.0? Well, that's a programming thing. Generally, I find it's a good idea never to put integers, so just 1, in expressions like this mathematically. Excel will handle it just fine. But most Unix and, not even Unix, I mean really Windows, detailed programming expressions like to see that decimal point. And so if you ever do this and you see, wow, that's really funky behavior, what's going on? It's possible that you just need to put in a decimal point somewhere. But we're not going to go into that again. That goes into the theory of computers and integer representations of numbers versus floating point representations of numbers. And it's all what makes computers so hard to deal with sometimes. But anyway, so I'm going to represent this function as nkx over 1 plus kx. And when I hit enter, Nuplot takes that just fine, meaning that it accepts that and has defined a function now.
I could call that function g, I could call it new, I could call it whatever I wanted, as long as I refer to it as, you know, in this case, f of x, or g of x, or new of x, as long as I refer to it consistently later on, I can call it whatever I want. But f of x is convenient for our purposes here, so that's why I called it that. And now I've got to give it some values of n and k, right? So remember when we did our parabolic fit, right? We tried a few values, and we saw that as we changed the values, the chi-squared got better or it got worse. And one thing about computers, they lack the intuition that you and I have. And so you can't just say, computer, figure out what the best parameter is. It wants to know whether it should try 3, whether it should try 300, whether it should try 3 billion. The computer isn't going to be able to just guess a value. And oftentimes, if you tell it to guess a value, it's just going to pick a random number and it's going to give you something totally ridiculous. And so in this situation, whenever you're doing fitting, you have to give your computer a rough idea of what you expect the values to be. Okay, and so in this case, the fact that we see the maximum value of nu end up being close to 3 or 4 tells us that, hey, maybe we should give it a rough estimate of 3, and then it can optimize further from there. But we have to give it an initial starting value that it's then going to minimize and find the optimum chi-squared. And so we do that very simply. We would just say n equals 3.0, and let's say k. Again, since we're in the, if we go back to our data, you know, K is in the micromolar range, and so we would expect K to have an order of, you know, 10 to the 6th-ish. Now that's, again, that's getting into physical chemistry. Maybe you won't realize that, so let's just give it a value of 100 and see what it does. Okay, so we don't really know what K is, but let's say we're going to guess 100 and try to have the program optimize from there. Okay, so now I've defined a model and I've defined some initial parameters for that model. We can always plot it. So here we've plotted our binding curve. We can also plot f of x. So if I just put a comma here between this plot statement and our next plot statement, it's going to plot both of them on the same axes. And maybe, let's try plot f of x first. Huh. Yeah, that makes sense. Starts here at 0 and it goes up and maxes out to 3. So I'm going to use another trick here. 0 to 1 e minus 5. Yeah, so it's working. Yep. So you can see our value here for our... Yeah, I'm just not that tall. It starts out at 0 and it eventually reaches an asymptote of around 3. Now again, if I make this a little bit more realistic, 0, let's make this 0.5. So now you can see we're seeing something that looks roughly like a binding curve. But then if I plot my data point along with that, so let's add binding.txt with y error bars. You can see this doesn't really agree all that well, right? Because my y error bars are here, or my data is here, and essentially I'm not even approaching my maximum of binding. And so k of 100 is a pretty lousy guess here. And so we're going to have to sort of see if the computer is smart enough to find a good value. I could make it a better value. So if I make, let's see if I make k of 1,000. It makes me 10,000. Yeah, that's better. So I think we what we're saying here is we don't necessarily know. I know I could put the number in, but that wouldn't be fair. Right, we don't necessarily know what the equilibrium constant is. And so let's see if we can tell Newplot, hey, find me the best value of the equilibrium constant here to use, because I'm really clueless. And we're going to use as our initial starting value for k of 10,000. And our initial starting value for n of 3. So the function that we want to use here is called fit. And we're going to say fit f of x. And then the next command that it takes is binding.txt. So the fitting function needs both our model and the experimental data. And then there's some additional stuff here. So using 1, 2, 3, that means it's going to use all three columns in binding.txt. So you don't have to give it an uncertainty for every data point. But if I say using 1, 2, 3, that means it's going to use that third column as the uncertainty. And again, this is gone over in your tutorial. So you can read up on it there. But that's why I'm saying that. And then the final thing I have to do is I have to tell it what parameters am I going to let it optimize, right? So I could define, you know, here I have n and k. Suppose my model for some reason had the value pi, but I didn't want to have to type 3.14159 all that stuff. I could define a variable pi so that I didn't have to keep typing all those numbers over and over again. But pi is a constant. I don't want to optimize that, right? So I'm going to tell it what parameters do I want it to optimize, and anything I don't put in here, it's going to leave those alone. In this particular case, these are the only parameters there are in the whole expression. So I don't have to worry about that. But if you do have a more complicated function that you want to define some other constants so that you don't have to keep typing the same number over and over again, just leave those out here, and it will use whatever value that you've set, if it's 3.14159 or 16 or whatever you have. So via, and the numbers I want to fit, again, are n and k. And so fingers crossed, this will work when I hit enter. Okay, so yay, it worked. It cranks through, so you see a whole bunch of stuff fly by. Remember what we had to do. We had to try a whole bunch of values and see whether chi-square was getting better or worse. And so all of these, you know, we have, you know, here's iteration 195, here's iteration 196. So basically in the blink of an eye, the computer's gone through about 200 different trials to try to find the best value of n and k to optimize your agreement between the model and the data. And so by the time it gets done, you can see here it's given you the final values of the parameters that it thinks are the best. And so here for n, it's 3.8 plus or minus 0.4. So now we're getting estimates of the uncertainty for the parameters. And for k, it's 1.07 times 10 to the 6th,
plus or minus 3.01 times 10 to the fifth. And so it's gone through and done that optimization, the same thing we did in Excel, but now it can give you some more statistical information about the fit itself. And now if I go back and do my plot, and nicely it sets the values of n and k for you. So if I type, so it sets the values of n and k to be the ones that it finds. And now if I go back and do my plotting command, I probably shouldn't need this anymore. Now you can see how it does the best fit. Okay, and so this is representative of the agreement between the model and the experimental data. And again, from this I can say, well, there's probably four binding sites, and the equilibrium constant for our data is 1 times 10 to the 6th, or the binding association constant is 1 times 10 to the 6th. And so here's a situation where we've done some experiments, we collected it, we put it into a file, and then we used Nuplot to generate some experimental or some model fitting for us. And again, the Nuplot tutorial that you have has another example where you might go through and fit a straight line to some data. And if you were in, if you were in a biochemistry class, what you would do here is you would generate a scattered plot, right? I mean, you would linearize your data. But realistically, the reason they developed scattered plots and linearized data, and Michaelis Netton type, hill plots and all these sort of 1960s, 1970s era biochemistry solutions where you plot like 1 over x versus x. The reason they did that was because they didn't have computers that could do nonlinear least squares fitting. But now we have a computer that can basically test 1,000 different combinations of N and K in the time that it takes one biochemist from the 1970s to generate a scattered plot. And so this is much more robust. It gives you much better estimates on the uncertainties of your parameters, and it's much less likely to be susceptible to transformation errors. And so when you plot like nu over L versus L, taking 1 divided by the concentration actually has some consequences when you think about the uncertainty. So if your uncertainty of L is 0.1 micromolar, your uncertainty of 1 over L is not going to be 10 micromolar. It transforms differently than that. And so by just fitting the curve to what you want to fit to, you actually save yourself a lot of hassle because you don't have to worry about those types of transformation errors. And so this is how graduate students, undergrads, scattered plot in your biochemistry book is fine. But for fitting real data that's going to be published, I strongly recommend doing nonlinear least squares fitting. If not using Nuplot, then using another program like MATLAB or Mathematica. It'll give you more stable and more reliable answers in the long run. And like I said, we sort of just brushed through Nuplot here. Your tutorial that you have to take home covers a lot more of the details on what the different commands do. But you can see you don't need a whole lot to do some very simple modeling based on what we've done here today. You guys have questions? Okay, well, I think I have a summary slide here. So biochemical models, extremely useful. Always nice to be able to predict and test predictions using your data. And the first step in that is to optimize parameters and get equilibrium constants, get enthalpies, get the parameters that you think are important, and then you can use that to make predictions later on. And while you can use Excel to do some model parameter estimation, programs like Nuplot, Mathematica, MATLAB, R, they all have functionality for doing this. Nuplot is simple. It's available on, well, it's free. It's available on many computer systems, so it's available on Mac, PC, and Linux, obviously. And you can use programs like that to fit parameters to your data. One nitpick, and hopefully I never hear you guys say this, you always fit the model to the data. You never fit the data to the model. Although, you know, you don't believe how many times it comes up, but some, you know, it's usually a student that, you know, is just nervous and says, I fit the data to the model. But really, if you were actually doing that, you would be manipulating your data, which is not what you want to be doing. And so you're fitting a model to your data using nuplot and nonlinear least squares. Okay? Any discussion on what we've talked about today? I mean, I know this is a lot of material, and it's new for many of you. I mean, that's the whole point, right? I mean, there's just not enough time to cover this type of stuff in a standard undergraduate curriculum, at least not as it's currently set out in chemistry. But certainly, if there's questions, or you guys, you know, if you guys have specific questions about your system or things that are interesting to you, you know, I have a little bit of time in here for discussion, but. You know, over the last 3 years, I think everybody's just ready to get out of here at this point. So, okay. Well, remember, tomorrow morning at 9, we have lab safety and chemical waste. Again, this is your opportunity. If you've never taken that class before, it's strongly recommended. And for the chemistry people, chemical waste is something you have to take every year. So this will get that out of the way. And I think that's tomorrow. There's also a lab notebook thing tomorrow morning, but you guys can read the program as easily as I can. So we'll see you here tomorrow, same time. No breakfast tomorrow. So, but we'll hopefully still see you. And have a good night.